Tax Update for Saturday, December the 30th, 2006. Welcome to the last Tax Update for December of 2006 as we get ready for the new year. This week, maybe not better late than never, the mark-to-market election under Section 475F. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the supporting document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CPE presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information for tax practitioners to subscribe to their services. Again, visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, a year is ending now, and we're getting ready for a new tax season for those of us in the accounting profession. So we're beginning to kind of work up and take a look at a little details closing out the year. And this year, this particular week, I want to take a look at an election that's important to understand, not because it comes up often in your practice, but because when it does come up, it's important to recognize it's out there. And we're going to deal with this through a case for a taxpayer who failed to make the election and then decided better and deciding, oh, maybe I should have done that, and tried to get a get-out-of-jail-free card from the tax court and unfortunately did not succeed in doing so. We're going to look at the rules under Section 475 and the issues for traders. Now, traders are one of those things that became very popular, shall we say, back in the dot-com era, when we had lots of clients who got these stock options, ended up with lots of money. Suddenly, they had significant wealth come in because the price of the stock had risen, and decided that since stocks were going up in general and all these tech stocks were rising, that they could then leave their jobs now and go out and make their money solely through day trading. And so day trading became a very, very popular pursuit among certain people in that period. Now, the other thing I noticed about my day trading clients in general, not all of them, but the vast majority of them managed to take their large fortune and turn it into a small one through day trading. In essence, losses were a normal part of the game here. In fact, the vast majority of day traders lost significant sums. Now, we'll take a look at that because there's an issue here for an election that can be made to hopefully convert that capital loss into something a little more useful. But the key is making sure it's made in a timely fashion. What we're looking at specifically is the mark-to-market election available to traders under Section 475F. And the election that needs to be made in compliance with Revenue Procedure 9917 to be able to have those losses treated as ordinary. Now, in the case of Knish versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum 2006-268, we have a taxpayer that too late decided, oops, I should have made that election, and tried to fix it, and we'll talk about why that didn't work for that taxpayer. Now, as noted, we have a very basic rule here for traders. Let's review the basic rules on traders. This won't really be a podcast on trading in general, because the whole rule of who is a trader and how they qualify could consume a whole nother podcast, and we don't have that time this week. But we're going to say that basically it's not a simple mechanical test to qualify as a trader, but a trader is somebody who basically plays on short-term swings in the market. They have lots of trades. They hold shares very, very short periods of time, usually in a matter of hours, basically between the time they buy a position and the time they sell it, certainly no longer than a day or two for the positions they're dealing with on their day trading. They're looking to take advantage of small short swings in the market price of the stock, and basically be able to make money off those swings by predicting them. Now, if you are a trader, there are really three types of ways of investing in securities. The general rule is an investor, somebody who's going for longer-term appreciation, at least more than a day, and that's the general rule that we tend to fall under for most of our clients. We'll see them as investors. Then there are dealers. Dealers are basically people who are brokers who are basically selling securities to the public and have the securities as inventory. The intermediate category is traders who basically have raised it up to a trader business level for those short-term swings, but who are not selling to the general public, but also are not long-term appreciation investors. Now, traders get a couple of advantages, even ignoring 475 for a moment. There is an advantage becoming a trader. Key advantage of being a trader is normally the expenses related to your activities of buying and selling stock are Section 212 expenses. 212 expenses are generally itemized deductions for an individual, and the 212 expenses are therefore subject to the 2% haircut because they're miscellaneous itemized. They're not one of those listed as not being subject to the haircut and not deductible for AMT purposes. So there's a couple of problems there. Once you become classified as a trader, though, that's considered a trader business. That takes the expenses out from 212, moves them up to code section 162. What's the good news there? 162 trader business expenses are generally deductible in computing AGI. They're not itemized deductions. As such, they also are deductible in computing the alternative minimum tax. So there's a couple of advantages there for your general expenses. But what's important to note is even though we have a trader business and what we're making our income from is basically gains on the sales of these securities over a short term, we still don't convert these securities from capital assets. Here's the general rule. If you take a look at Section 1221A, you're going to discover that that's definition of a capital asset is basically all property a taxpayer holds. And then there are a list of exceptions for items that are not capital. So again, this is a type of definition we see quite often in the code, where we have a broad brush definition that includes everything, and then we start whittling things out of the mix. Well, there are two things whittled out of the mix that become important for us in this case, neither one of which are going to cover in this case. 1221A1 excludes from the definition of capital assets stock in trade in your business, basically inventory. If I have inventory for sale to the public, that is not a capital asset, and Section 1221 defines it as such. Secondly, Section 1222A2 excludes from the definition of a capital asset items are basically property used in a trade or business that is subject to depreciation. Well, now, if you look at this and think about it, the securities held by the trader who is conducting the trading activity fit neither one of those definitions. The trader, in fact, basically, it is not inventory for sale to the public, nor is it an asset that's depreciable. So that is still a capital asset. Well, that means, therefore, our sales proceeds are either capital gains or losses. At the end of the year, we have net capital gain, net capital loss. Now, that causes us some interesting problems, as you're aware, if you have a situation where the taxpayer loses a lot of money on these trades, which, to be honest, is the normal situation for most traders. Yes, successful ones go the other way, but most are not successful, and therefore most end up with significant capital losses. Here we run into the problem that Section 1211 strictly limits those losses, and as an individual, we're going to get them at $3,000 a year. It is very often the case, if you see a trader who has not made the 475 election, that in essence they have accumulated what's effectively a lifetime supply of capital loss carryover. Because they now have large six-figure capital losses, they exhausted their fortune, they have no investment assets or very little left. They're not going to make this money again because they stumbled into, essentially, the options gain, and that was their money and that was their nest egg, which now is gone. And they have no real capital assets, and they're so burned on the stock market anyway, they're not likely to hold anything that's going to appreciate dramatically, and certainly not enough to appreciate to recover their losses. So these people end up with a $3,000 a year capital loss carry forward going forward forever. Interestingly enough, this is the second time this comes into play for our dot-com groups. We talked about earlier the issue for ISOs and the AMT limitation of the $3,000 loss when your ISO crashes. This time, now again, the dot-commers get hit by that 1211 restriction, this time for the fact of their day trading and the limitation on the losses going forward. But there is a solution to this one. That solution is found in Section 475F. Section 475F deals with a method of accounting. As you might suspect, it's in the 400 series, seems to be in the methods area. And this is an election that's available under Section 475F that you can elect to mark to market for traders in securities and commodities. What that means, if you make the election under Section 475F, 475F1 defines for us, basically, as of the end of each taxable year, we take all the securities, all the positions currently held, We mark them up to their market price at the close of that day, and we treat them as if they were sold on that day. And we take into account any gain or loss at that point and then adjust our basis going forward for the next year. Now, that transaction takes place, and we do that each year for securities. Now, remember, a trader usually is holding shares only for a few hours, maybe a day. So normally, we would not see a huge number of positions outstanding at the end of the day, or at least nothing significant compared to the amount of trades for the year. But we can make this election. Now, you may think, especially when you look at that, if you've had a day trader client, you've seen that truly is in day trading. You've seen those huge printouts of trade activity that go on every day. And, you know, you have this 300-400 page document for gains or losses. You understand that generally it's probably going to be relatively immaterial, this adjustment at the end of the day, since almost certainly, remember, we're looking at 12/31 here as our date for almost all of your taxpayers. Most traders would not feel comfortable, if they're really in day trading and doing it consistently, of having a lot of positions outstanding over a holiday. You know, especially this year where those positions are going to be outstanding from Friday all the way through Tuesday, or it may even be Wednesday since we have the day of mourning for President Ford, and I haven't checked to see if the markets are going to close on Tuesday. But we could have positions outstanding, therefore if the markets are closed on Tuesday, all the way through next Wednesday before they'll be able to come back in and sell those positions off again. Well, they're not going to be comfortable holding for that period of time when things can happen they've not predicted. So therefore, what we're going to find is most of them will have most of them gone and out. So it becomes an issue. Secondly, you think about it, it also eliminates our ability just to decide, well, maybe we'll hold on to this one big winner here at the end of the year and recognize it next year because I want to push the income into next year. So in one sense, you look at this election and go, why would I want to make it? Well, there's a simple answer coming forward. The general rule is found in section 475 F1D, and it invokes the ordinary gain or loss treatment that applies for dealers under 475 D3A. What that means is rather than being capital losses and capital gains for this purpose, we are going to treat these gains or losses as ordinary gains or losses. Well, ordinary gains are, I guess, okay, better than short-term capital gains, maybe from the theory that, or may not be, I should say, better than short-term, they're probably worse than short-term capital gains, not much worse, but a little bit. The downside being if we have losses from other capital asset activities, we can't offset them against those gains. So we may end up with the $3,000 coming at us because we have other assets that aren't part of the trading activity we took losses on. We can't offset that. So that might be bad ordinary gain treatment. But ordinary loss treatment is clearly a lot better than capital loss treatment when you have net losses for the year in excess of $3,000. Not only do we get those losses, but they can generate, since we're in a trader business, a net operating loss deduction. Well, that basically helps us on a couple of ways to take care of this and straighten things out. So net operating losses also allow us to go back and recover prior year's tax. In many of these cases, the taxpayer in question has huge prior year income because that's where they generated all of this money that they then use for their day trading activity, was from that exercise of option and same day sale from a year ago that suddenly gave them this $1 million to go play with. So now the taxpayer is able to carry their loss back when things go wrong and at least recover the taxes they paid on establishing their nest egg. Now, as should be clear, this election would be absolutely great if we could make it at the end of the year. If we could wait, see if the person had gains or losses, and then make the election. Now note, once this election is made, you have to keep using this method every year into the future. Unless you get the permission of the IRS to change the method. Well, since usually you'd make this election, you'd like to make it because you had a total disaster and the person is going to get out of day trading, that may not be terribly relevant to you that you have to continue to use it. So maybe that's not really a concern of yours. But making the election is an issue. Now, the code section in question allows the IRS to prescribe the methods and means of making this election by regulation. Now, the IRS has never actually issued final regulations in this area. However, they did issue Revenue Procedure 9917 that provides rules for making the election. Now, the general issue is that you have to file a statement that describes the election being made. It's 475F election. The first taxable year for which you want this election to be made, and the trade or business for which the election is made. Well, that's fine, relatively simple, straightforward, easy. The key issue becomes when we have to make this election and how we do it. If you take a look at Section 5 of the Revenue Procedure under Paragraph 03 and 1 under that, you will note that this statement must be filed with the due date without regard to extensions of the original federal income tax return for the taxable year immediately preceding the election year, or and must be attached to that return, or if we don't file the return, we go on extension, we attach it to the request for extension of time to file that return. Interesting aside caveat, that also therefore means it would seem awfully difficult to file an e-filed extension with that, since there's no method of attaching to an e-filed extension this. You would file a paper extension in that question, in that issue. Nevertheless, going on and skipping on to the next point, what we have to look at here is that we have to get this election in place fairly early. So a taxpayer who in 2006 wanted to have this election be applicable for this year, essentially an individual had to have filed the election by April 15th of this year, and they had to file it with their income tax return or with the application for an extension of time to file that they filed by April 15th. Obviously, that brings up a couple of issues, too. If you missed your extension or you forgot to get the extension, apparently you've lost the right to make this election. Minor detail. But the important part is, why is that date so early? Because the IRS realized the same thing that we probably realized looking at this instantly. We could really, really would like to wait until the last day, until after the end of the year, to decide if we want to make this election. And the IRS decided that was not Congress's intent, was not to let people second guess and pull this off. It was you had to make your call up front. So the IRS in the revenue procedure requires you to make this election early in the year. Now that's important because the code itself makes no mention of when the election has to be made. Now let's take a look at the Knish case. Knish versus Commissioner, 2006-268. The Knishes had an operating S corporation that sold off its operating assets. That S corporation was SPK. It's referred to in the case a couple of times. In February of 2000. And then during that year, they took some of the assets they didn't take as a distribution from that corporation and began day trading in the corporation, the S corporation with those assets, plus went ahead and did some also day trading with their own personal assets. Now, they timely filed their 1999 income tax returns for both the corporation and their personal returns. And in neither case did they put a 475F election attached to the return. As we should note right off, obviously they didn't follow Revenue Procedure 9917, and according to 9917, we don't have a valid election at this time. So what did they do? I presume at some point down the line it became clear to Mr. Knish that, oh, maybe we should have done this. So Mr. Knish basically in 2001 attempted to make the mark-to-market elections. The petitioners, which means Mr. Knish and the corporation, each filed a Form 3115, that's the application for change in accounting method, with the IRS and noted at the top the forms were filed pursuant to Regulation Section 301.9100-2, which, if you may remember from a prior podcast, was an automatic method of getting certain elections extended. Now, key issue to discuss right here. One of the items not listed as an automatic extension is this particular extension. That presents us with some interesting side problems that, you know, that's probably the wrong section. However, Regulation 301.9100-3 does provide the IRS can make discretionary relief in certain cases. And we will discuss whether that could work in this case because the tax court discussed whether that worked in this case. Now, Mr. Knish didn't have stellar performance in picking stocks, as you can guess. In fact, he generated significant losses. And if his 475F election is valid, he created significant net operating losses that were carried back to a number of previous years and generated pretty significant refunds. The IRS ultimately said, Mr. Knish, sorry, we don't think you have a valid 475F election, and as such, we are going to disallow your deduction. And we're going to basically say, sorry, you can only take $3,000 of the deduction each year, and any excess must be carried forward and used up basically at $3,000 a year. Now, Mr. Knish did initially try to get a private letter ruling from the IRS granting him this late election. And he filed those ruling requests that they should be granted administrative relief. However, they withdrew their ruling request when it became clear that they weren't going to get a positive response. That's a fairly normal mode for when you're not going to get a positive response. The bad news, of course, is now everybody's aware of what's going on, and everybody's aware that there's this big issue sitting out there. So Mr. Knish has now a little problem, and eventually we end up in tax court over this issue. Now, the IRS argued two points in the case, and only one of them is decided in this particular case. The IRS argued there was not a valid election, and just in case the court happened to hold that the election might be valid, because, by the way, the tax court did, in a case that Mr. Knish relies upon later, or attempts to rely upon in the Vines case, did grant late election relief in one case. You may want to go back and look at that case if you have a client who missed the election and can meet the Vines fact pattern. But just in case the court decided this case was like Vines, the IRS took the position as well that he wasn't really a traitor. He didn't do it long enough or significant enough. Now, we aren't going to discuss that because in this particular case, that was not an issue the tax court decided they had to decide. They'd already basically decided that he lost, Mr. Knish lost, even if he was a traitor. But do realize the shorter period someone stays involved in the transactions and the smaller number of trades involved, the more likely it is the IRS is going to be able to succeed in claiming you never were a traitor. So if they go through their pile of funds real quick, you may find difficulty sustaining the position that somebody was a trader or that they were trading at that point. As well, you must have extremely significant trades in order to make the trader work. So a significant number of trades have to take place. Now, the tax court noted the IRC itself does not provide a time period in which the election has to be made. So they looked to the legislative history of Section 375. And said, you know, we looked at the legislative history because the code section is kind of silent on what authority the IRS might have in this area. But they said the legislative history supporting this particular case, and they quote from the House report specifically, indicates that Congress clearly intended for the IRS to have the right to set the time frame for making this election. Now, the court notes initially what was obvious when we first started discussing this. There is no way we're even close to meeting the requirements of Revenue Procedure 9917. Basically, the court noted they did not require they did not attach a statement electing mark to market for their 99 returns to make a timely election, nor did they attach any election statement to the 99 returns as noted. Instead, they filed their election in October 2001 for their returns for 2000. They note the election statements were filed nearly 18 months late after the fact. So the court said, well, clearly they didn't make a 991 election. There's no way these are just foot fault issues or little minor details that are involved that aren't really significant. It's like this is way offline versus the requirements. So we're not about to say that you should be granted the election because you came close, because you didn't even come close. Now, Mr. Knish then tried to argue, well, even if they weren't effective for 2000, they should be effective for 2001 if I make a late election and bad. Well, the court noted a couple of facts here. First, their election, even if they granted that election and saying it was going to be valid for 2001 because they got in too late for 2000, the court noted this would have been late for a 2001 election too. We're talking about October of 2001. That election had to be made by April of 2001. Obviously, we're behind and we got that election late as well. But secondly, the court noted that even if that election was timely or deemed timely enough under the Vines theory to allow that election to pass muster, the court noted that there's nothing in the ruling, nothing in any background that suggests that you can basically use the next year automatically. Remember, Revenue Procedure 9917 specifically stated you were supposed to indicate which year the election was effective for. Well, if you said it was effective for 2000 and it couldn't be, you don't automatically get 2001. That's an important secondary issue to remember if you have this problem or somebody makes the election late. You may find out if an election has been made late or apparently late, you may need a second election to make the next year stick. So the court notes, even if the election had been filed, even if 3115 had been filed prior to April 15, 2001, it still would not have been valid for 2001 unless it had mentioned 2001. Okay, the taxpayers try to recover now. They say, well, the IRC required the IRS to issue regulations to govern these provisions, and this is a revenue procedure, not a regulation. The court did not accept that reasoning. It noted that, basically, they previously considered the validity of Revenue Procedure 9917 and concluded that, basically, it meets the requirements for the authority. As well, they go on to note, quoting from the Lehrer case, and they find that the facts here are very similar, that if your election still, regardless, was 18 months late, no matter whether or not they thought maybe the IRS needed to issue a regulation to truly tie down the time frame, the court felt there is no way it was reasonable to presume that Congress intended for people to be able to wait till October of the following year to make an election for this particular mark-to-market issue that clearly was going to be influenced or could be subject to Monday morning quarterbacking, where you re-decide and say, oops, I should have, you know what, I need that election because my year's been so awful, so I'm going to second guess now and go ahead and make the election. That's an unreasonable interpretation of the provision even without regulations. Therefore, even if Revenue Procedure 9917 were not valid or basically it didn't count to set the date, the court went on to state they still wouldn't allow it in this case. Now, finally, the taxpayers argued, well, maybe then we should have been granted late relief election under Section 9100 and the regulations under there. Now, the court noted this argument appeared to have been raised late in the process, but regardless of whether it was too late to raise the issue, it doesn't matter because they don't see it as valid in any event as a method involved. As you may recall, when we discussed that late election relief, there are a couple of requirements that you must show in order to get the late relief that's not automatic when you go to 9100-3. You must show you acted reasonably and in good faith and that a grant of relief would not prejudice the interests of the government. The court specifically finds there was not good faith here. As noted in the regulation itself, a taxpayer is deemed not to have acted reasonably and in good faith if the taxpayer uses hindsight in requesting relief. You know, the court goes on to say, quote, a taxpayer attempting to make a mark-to-market election years after it is due while continuing to trade in the meantime is an attempt to convert capital losses to ordinary losses, the classic example of a taxpayer seeking to use hindsight. And said this is specifically what petitioners and their corporation are attempting to do is convert. Now, the court contrasts this with the Vines case, which the taxpayers wanted to rely upon saying, well, Vines was allowed a late election. In the Vines case, the attorney in question did not make the election timely, no question. However, the attorney made no trades after the due date of the return in question, so he got out of the day trading operation before April 15th of that year, essentially would be the fact pattern, and therefore had no benefit. Basically, he had the same facts in front of him at the date he attempted to make the election a few months late as he would have had the election been made timely. In that case, the court found he acted in good faith, the IRS should have granted relief, and the court did require the IRS to grant relief by saying that basically he acted reasonably in good faith and the interests of the government were not prejudiced because essentially it was basically the same fact pattern and the same decision that could have been made on the day in question, and he gained no benefit from delaying the election. He did not get to suddenly determine if he had later gains or losses and whether he wanted to make the election. As a note, that is not the case in Knish, who clearly benefited from significant amounts of trades conducted after April 15th of 2000, April 15th, 2000, and had the benefit of hindsight for those trades in 2000-2001 when he attempted to make this election. Therefore, he could not qualify for Vines relief. Now, where does that put tax professionals? Well, this election is in many ways a risky one for those of us in tax practice. Key issue, you need to make sure that you and your staff recognize where a possibility for this election exists, and you raise the flag and raise the issue. The problem is, because of the due date of this, April 15th, essentially for individuals, this is not the sort of issue you can put off and take care of after tax season. If somebody's going to need this election to be made, it has to be made during tax season. As well, it's important to understand and raise it with your clients because ignorance is no defense in this area either. We have a number of cases in that regard where merely the fact I didn't know about this election does you no good. And the client will almost certainly claim he was relying upon you to tell him, and of course he let you know, and you guys kind of knew what was happening, so you should have been aware this was going on. It's also important that you document that you gave client the full disclosure of the options, and you specifically explain to them the thing maybe they don't want to hear, which is if you lose your shirt in this area and have significant losses, which of course they'll deny that's ever going to happen, usually when they're getting into it. Nobody would get into this believing they're going to lose hundreds of thousands of dollars. They just do. But nevertheless, because they're going to deny that, you still need to explain to them, if you don't make this election and you incur significant losses well in excess of $3,000, you're going to find situations where we may have a huge chunk of losses you will effectively never be able to use or use extremely slowly in the future. And that's going to be a problem that if we made this election today, we wouldn't have that issue. Now, at that point, if the client turns down the election, as they probably will, usually they want to turn it down because they say, oh, no, I'm going to make a fortune. This is easy. I know I'm going to make a fortune. And all your other clients are just wrong, and they didn't know what they were doing. They're obviously too stupid, but I'm not that stupid. I know how to make the money. And when they tell you that, you need to document that was done so next December and January of the following year, when they suddenly look at what happened during the year and the disaster and the debacle they're coming out of, and realize they now have $600,000 of losses, but that's still going to mean they're going to owe tax this year because they're only going to get $3,000 loss, and they still have the tax on their or on their other income that they ran during the year, so they still owe federal income tax. Once they figure that out, they will have second thoughts and decide, oh, well, if you'd have told me right, I would have made the election. That's why you need to document what was going on. And that's a key issue and a key exposure, especially if clients are prone to have different memories of situations. I would suggest this is one of those you'd like to give a letter to the client explaining the situation and to document what they did. Well, this has been the tax update for another. We're finishing another calendar year. 2006 is finishing up. 2007 is going to get started. This is also my first tax update that I'm doing on a new MacBook that's actually in here. So I've got a MacBook running now instead of the old iBook that was running this. So we'll see how the sound quality, if that changes at all. We've got the versions of Audacity for the Intel Macs running on this system, as well as my other updated information to run and hopefully upload this podcast relatively quickly under this system. And we'll be seeing how things go. Hopefully you all enjoyed your new year. I suspect most of you are listening to this after the new year, so that's why we went into this topic rather than some year-end planning topic, since I figured that's done by now. It certainly is for me. It's now Saturday, and if any client hasn't done their year-end planning by now, I'm not really going to be involved with working with them at this point. It's like they need to deal with it themselves. Unfortunately, now I take the weekend off, especially this close to tax season. Tax Update, as always, is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Again, visit their site, take a look at signing up for their newsletters with updates that are important that go on for tax professionals throughout the year. Again, on the web at www.limeburg.com. And this has been Tax Update for December 30th, 2006.